Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It was Friday, the 19th of December, 1997, and shortly after 6 a.m., Neil Whittaker arrived at the Sydney Football Stadium, preparing for one of the busiest and most pivotal days of his career. A full day of meetings with club bosses, league administrators and board members, all gathered to decide on a 19-point proposal to end the war that had forever changed rugby league in Australia and around the world. At 2:50, the ARL's General Committee put it to a vote. By 3:13, the numbers were in. The war was over, and the National Rugby League was born. This is Peace, the 40th chapter in the Rugby League Digest in-depth investigation of the Super League War. Welcome back to the Rugby League Digest. I'm Michael Adams here with Andrew Paskin. How's it going, Andy?
I'm wonderful. A little bit forlorn given it's the last chapter, mate.
The last chapter. We made it. They said we'd never do it, but we got here and only, you know, 6 years or so after schedule. But we're here now.
Well, technically, we said we'd never make it as well.
Yeah. So the last chapter, not our last episode. We have a little epilogue that we'll fill you in on at the end. So this is where we leave the story. By the end of this episode, the National Rugby League is born, the NRL, the competition that we're still enjoying these many years after. So, I mean, it's obvious that the last chapter will be quite pivotal, but this one really is an important one.
Looking back over the research for this one, the extensive research, it was like double the usual dossier, but it just filled me with some sort of pride because of how far the game's come since 1998. It's really amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in our little epilogue, we can delve a bit more into that. Just thought at the start, I'd lay the groundwork for what we will be doing in this episode. So this will basically be a chronological retelling of the road to peace throughout 1997, culminating in that meeting where the vote was had and the NRL was born. So we start the story back in October, November, basically as soon as that court case came down in favour of Super League. The two competitions were on, but the road to peace began because I think the judgment on October 4, by October 5, everyone knew that, like, well, we can't be doing this. I think what you'll see over the course of this year and over the course of this chapter is that it was always a case of one step forward and two steps back, and one party being conciliatory and the other party going on attack, and then the roles being reversed a few weeks later, and then coming together and then making this, you know, bold announcement only for 2 weeks later for that to all fall apart and the public to be left in the lurch again and wondering if this was ever going to be sorted out.
Going through all the material, I can't believe they got it done.
Yeah.
With the people involved,
yeah,
the parties involved, it's incredible that it got done.
Yeah, and we're going to hear a lot from those parties throughout this episode, so let's just get into it. I'm going to start with a quote from John Rebo in January, which I think this little section illustrates some of the issues and some of the false dawns that we'd see over the ensuing year. So Nine did the deal with Super League to broadcast Super League that was the final ride in Narco's back that dragged him right down. But for Super League, this was seen as a real victory and for John Rebo, a sign that the game would come together. So Rebo said, "I've said over the last few months that we're all compromised out, but I think this announcement now has made the products more compatible, the products being the ARL and Super League. There's every opportunity we can talk because we're now not having a fight." But that's Rebo's comment. And later in the month, it was clear that nothing had actually been said between the two parties, that compromise was still an abstract concept at this point. And Ian Frickberg actually came out and, you know, dampened that sentiment from Rebo, saying compromise is not a part of our plans. We don't have an agenda which involves the two groups getting together. So This is January 1997, and you can see from a Super League perspective, they're trying to launch a competition, and they had to be on the front foot and saying, well, the ARL has their game, we've got our game, that's our focus. At the same time that he was saying that publicly, months later it was reported that during January, he ran into Jeff Carr on Bondi Beach. They were both, you know, regulars there, and the two of them had a bit of a chat, which led to a series of informal chats between the two of them going for a walk on the beach.
Can anything happen in rugby league without a chance meeting?
And I don't want to oversell how important these meetings were, because ultimately, you know, everything had to be decided at a much higher level than walking down Bondi Beach.
For example, if you went to Tamarama that day, is the game still split? You know, so can we just get things more formally organized regarding meetings?
But I think what it does show you is that at all stages, you've got the public face and what was going on behind the scenes. And at various points, it was expedient for one party to be really belligerent about it, and other times more conciliatory. But I think behind the scenes, both parties knew the whole time that, you know, this could only afford to be a one-year proposition, and they had to somehow get it together for 1998. So I think those two kind of things are always going on at the same time. But in that early part of the year, compromise wasn't really on the agenda because of what I just said. Both parties had to concentrate on getting their competition up and running. For the ARL, part of that was making sure that they still had the clubs to run that competition. So as we've learned, anytime they need to do that, they whip out a loyalty agreement. So at this stage, the clubs were asked to sign a five-year agreement. Neil Whittaker said, there's no pressure and no deadline. So yeah, I'm sure that's the case. No pressure at all, guys. Just asking if you want to sign in blood here for the next 5 years.
If I was one of the ARL clubs, I'd be like, have you got a month-to-month option? I don't really want to sign a contract.
Well, I think that was in the air. So there were some waiverers to that deal, like some clubs who signed instantly, but Parramatta and St. George were holding off. I think they were a bit wary and were keen to see how the wind blew. George Piggins weighed in and said, if anyone was to pull out now, that would be the biggest Judas act I've ever seen. It would be worse than those clubs who've already left. But all clubs did sign. And just an interesting point on the concept of a loyalty agreement, which had burned the ARL in the past and deemed anti-competitive. Paul Kent wrote an article where he was talking about the new loyalty agreements, and apparently the ARL had legal advice that these were fine. And part of that was because now that the ARL did have established competition in Super League, the loyalty agreement was no longer anti-competitive.
Mm.
So just an interesting little legal wrinkle there. But I think the ARL were right to try to get that loyalty, because one of the things Super League were doing at various points was to be talking about how clubs were on the verge of jumping ship. You know, there were always these 2 to 3 clubs who were rumoured to be days away from signing with Super League.
It was the halcyon days of the back page of the Telegraph, that was.
Yeah. I mean, slow news day, just another club is on the verge of jumping ship. And I don't actually know that any ARL clubs at this stage were really seriously considering it. If they hadn't come together for 1998, then maybe it's a different proposition there. But so into March and April, the season starts, and it makes sense that there's nothing happening in terms of compromise, because talking about it publicly, at least, may be a sign of capitulation, or, you know, from Super League, an admission that their grand new vision for rugby league wasn't delivering as promised.
Why would you talk about it and take the focus off the fireworks pre-game? I mean,
yeah.
$1 million in fireworks.
Yeah. So at this stage, Super League were very much proceeding under the line that we believe there will be one competition in 1998, but that competition will be called Super League.
I couldn't think of a worse marketing scenario than that. The most toxic brand since DDT or something.
Yeah.
Hated by everybody, including Super League fans. Let's use that.
Yeah, well, that's for a bit further down the line. In March, the rugby league loving public was still about to be blown away by Belinda Carlisle and Chubby Checker and fireworks and, you know, the Australian Beach Boys show.
Let's not tarnish the good name of Belinda Carlisle here, please.
Hey, we're long-standing admirers. So that, yeah, not a slight at all. So I think John Rebo's statement is illustrative. I think as the season unfolds, people will see how one competition will come about. This idea of a peace deal being brokered is wrong. I don't know where that's come from. Yeah, so nothing happening throughout March and April. By May, reality was starting to bite a bit. So I think both competitions were underwhelming the public in their own special ways. And then there were external pressures as well that were making it less likely that two competitions were sustainable. So there was a new government tax on poker machines that were going to have a severe impact on leagues club revenue. The reduced revenue also came from dwindling interest in the game and falling crowds, etc. And so by May, I think it was becoming more pressing that we need to make this happen.
It's beyond ironic that compromises expedited by the pokey tax, like all roads lead back to pokies.
Yeah, absolutely. So May also saw the first bold pronouncement that turned out to be wildly premature. Peter Frelingos reported that this week's meeting of Super League CEOs in Canberra was told the end of the war is about 8 weeks away. In the Sun Herald, Ian Heads wrote, "If you can believe rugby league's loudest whisper, a deal has already been done for 1998.
That was the funniest one through all the rumours, was the done deal. Like, in rugby league, everything's always a done deal.
Yeah, I know. And I wanted to bring this up at this point because we've got so many more done deals to come throughout the next few months. And one of the things I like about the done deal at this point in time is that it all came down to an agreement that had been done between James Packer and Lachlan Murdoch.
Chance meeting?
No, this was actually planned. It was a deal for Channel 9 to continue to show rugby league in 1998. As if that is, like, you know, the most pivotal part of the war. It's the easiest part of solving this dilemma is sorting out Channel 9. It's, how does the meeting go? You know, like, oh yeah, so Channel 9, keen to show the games next year? Yep, sounds good. You're going to show them live? Well,
people were assigned genius designations quite easily back then.
Yeah.
The most obvious shit ever.
Yeah. So Whittaker and Frickberg both came out in May that said that they hadn't had any talks. So it wasn't happening. But there was talks about talks. So John Rebo told journalists in Brisbane there was a 90% chance of talks in coming weeks.
We've given him, I think, a fair shake. We've given him the respect he was due and never received, really, in the mainstream. And we've pulled him up on a few poor efforts. But he loves the sound of his own voice, this bloke.
I think by this point in the war, and I think he realised it, that it was kind of above his pay grade. Like, the what needed to be sorted out, you know, it wasn't going to be him in the meeting making the deal happen. And I think you can see that with him, you know, leaving the post of Super League CEO and parachuting into Melbourne.
That comment was like little Carmine Sopranos level.
Yeah. But May did see an actual meeting happen eventually. So there was an informal meeting between Whittaker and Frickberg, which was described as just an ice-breaking exercise, but it was some progress anyway. But I love this rugby league club administrator mentality. So it's reported this informal meeting took place. Bob Ferris at the Hunter Mariners says, "I believe it's been done, and I believe it's been done in the best interest of rugby league." So multi-million dollar conflicts, Byzantine contracts, TV rights, future control of the game. All we need is an informal meeting between the two guys, and it's done. But it was an important step because it was the first time that the likes of Rebo and Frickberg were talking publicly and positively about compromise, and compromise that might not be all on Super League's terms. So that was a positive step. But then the ARL launches its State of Origin campaign with a game in Melbourne. You know, the day they announced the Melbourne Origin game, Super League swans in to say that they're setting up a club in Melbourne for 1998, which Ian Head's called a provocative tactic, and I have to agree with that. That was the first but not the last of these broadsides. So you'd see positive talks and a real sense that it was coming together undermined by these little potshots coming from either direction. So we go into June, and with this spirit of compromise in the air, talks grew louder about a Super Bowl.
The El Dorado of hypotheticals.
Yeah, well, and really it had been an Eldorado from the time of that court case. You know, once we knew we had two comps, the speculation about a Super Bowl started. By June, it started to pick up, with Super League announcing that it had kept a date in place on its calendar just in case it happened to come to pass.
Do you know what? We've been talking about the Super Bowl thing for what, 6 years on and off at length. I've always been pro the Super Bowl game just to see who was the best. But thinking about it now, I think we dodged a bullet not having it.
I agree, but I think there's a different world in which it could have worked.
But I just think in rugby league terms, there always been an excuse. Oh, well, our comp finished 2 weeks earlier. We didn't have the momentum. Someone tripped over at training. There'd always be some sort of claim, and it wouldn't be as legitimate, I don't think, as an actual Super Bowl.
I think that's true. But to my point, I think it comes down to the fact that it wasn't built in to the competition structure from the start. So in June, Super League announced it had a date reserved. That date was October 25, which was the only date that its players would be available because they had a test against New Zealand on the 26th of September. They had the World Club Challenge finals running between the 3rd and 18th of October, and then a test series in England from November 1. So really, the only way they could have done it would be to scrap the World Club Challenge, which, like,
why would you scrap your jewel in the crown? You wouldn't do that.
Yeah. So basically, the date that Super League gave the ARL, the Knights would have had their grand final 3 to 4 weeks before and wouldn't have had any football since. I mean, that gap might have suited them. A Chief would have only just been back in shoes by October 25.
Well, I reckon they would have been complaining about the scheduling and momentum thing and threatening to get on the drink again.
Yeah. Well, yeah, this is what I want to ask you. And going to your point, which I think is very true, even if it was built into the schedule and all year both competitions knew that they'd have their grand final and the winner would play a Super Bowl, would the scenes in Newcastle have been the same if the players knew that they had to stay in shape for a Super Bowl in a couple of weeks?
No way.
I think it really would have undermined what we got in Newcastle. And as happenstance as that is, you know, and if Manly win the grand final, you know, maybe it's a different story. Just for the fact that it would have taken away from one of the greatest explosions of joy in rugby league history, I'm very glad that we didn't get the Super Bowl.
It might have been great, who knows? But I mean, the way rugby league people, the way we are, everyone would have been just complaining about something.
Yeah, yeah. I tend to agree. Even Wayne Bennett, he was one of the people who was anti a Super Bowl. He said, if it's on, I just hope they send out somebody else's team. Mine's a bit tired. So I think you're right. Ultimately, we dodged a bullet. But the speculation was a lot of fun. There were players on both sides for and against it. Typically, Super League players were more anti. Ricky Stewart, perhaps more belligerent than most, but echoing most Super League players. He goes, it just goes to show their players want to be more and more part of our competition. Why wouldn't they want to? They're not going to have any real competition in their rep season, and the main players will have no major games to look forward to. If they don't need Super League, why do they want to play against us? Why can't we just have our comp and promote the game in other parts of the world, which they weren't interested in? I'm not going to rattle off who was for, who was against, but one of my favorite comments came from Barry Gomesall, who for some reason in 1997 was asked about what he thought about a Super Bowl. And he was for it, and he said, I'd love to referee a Super Bowl game. So
that really made my day. He was like 11 years retired or something.
Yeah.
The biggest character of all characters in refereeing history. I just wish we had more of him now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also wish that they'd asked him if he would ref at Fair Dinkum if he did get the gig.
You would be hilarious. We've got this showpiece game, this glitz thing. We're going to China, and he comes out in those little shorts. That would probably get some eyes in China going, yeah. What's going on over there in Australia?
Mal Meninga, I think his idea was good to open the season with the winners of each comp playing.
Well, I disagree because in rugby league, there's always a 4 week period where 17 knock-ons a game is acceptable.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say the same thing. So in the end, they went with Brisbane versus Manly as the big marquee fixture of the opening weekend, which, you know, that was still seen as a big battle. It just goes to show you, nobody expected Manly to fall off as quickly as they did so that, you know, they scrape into the finals in 1998, but it took them a long time to get back to being a force.
It was quite a nice bookend that was the opening game in 88 when Brisbane were in the comp.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like only 10 years later that NRL was born and all that bullshit in between. It seems like about 30 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. In many ways, we're closer now to 1998 in terms of the game than 88 was to 98.
Mm.
So beyond the Super Bowl, June saw not much doing in terms of compromise talks. But it's at this point that in the press you're seeing reports of some of the major obstacles and some of the roadblocks to peace that would dominate discussion for the next few months. So we're just going to go through a few of those now. One of the biggest sticking points from the Super League side was the $300 million investment that they'd made in the game. So they were demanding that that was a debt to News Limited that needed to be repaid by whatever configuration the new rugby league competition would take.
I mean, no hide, no Christmas box with that request. Jesus.
Well, I sympathise with the ARL's sentiment. So this was an unnamed ARL source. As far as we're concerned, that's money down the drain. We can't be expected to worry about that.
A perfect rugby league quote.
Well, this is even better. I love this from Roy Masters, speaking about News Limited's idea that they needed the debt and how crazy this was to rugby league people. He wrote, "Super League is already battling an entrenched club culture that has never considered debt repayment or revenue raising a major responsibility."
But just the audacity, right? That'd be like Al-Qaeda going, "Listen, we put a lot of money into this World Trade Center thing and we're going to have to recoup it." I mean...
Yeah. But to give the News Limited perspective, they were wanting to stay involved in the game and be part of the new setup. So their argument was that, well, this $300 million is part of our investment into the game that will need to be paid back over time. And I think in terms of the public perception, no one cares about News Limited's investment. So I think Ian Head's, again, sums it up perfectly. The response of so many people to the fact that Super League now has a debt of $300 million is, so bloody what? They caused the whole thing. It's their debt, not rugby league's.
Absolutely. But I just love the ARL guy's ability to recognise money down the drain and to also recognise it's not their problem. If anyone knows money down the drain, it's ARL type.
Yeah. And also to just be so blasé about, yeah, it's down the drain. don't worry about it. So that was one of the big sticking points. The other was control of the game. So, you know, talks about the ARL must have control. That line was still being run. Super League, on the other hand, were like, if we're putting all the money in, we need to have ultimate financial control. This, I guess, is more reasonable, that if you are investing so much money that you should have a say in what happens to it. Part of this obstacle was that the deal Super League were offering at this point was essentially the same that they offered in 1995, that yes, we'll come together, we have financial control, so we will run everything at the top end. The ARL, you will look after junior development, the referee system, blah, 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 etc. So it was the same deal where ultimately all the power would be with News Limited and the ARL would be in more of an administrative role.
Quite a condescending offer, right? Mate, if you want to look after the refs, you know, cut some oranges up, you know, just sort of pitch in at the canteen if you can.
Yeah. So Neil Whittaker wasn't giving ground on this issue. He said, "It's not in our charter to surrender a community asset. I can understand News wanting to protect its investment, but the Australian Rugby League, the New South Wales Rugby League, going back 90 years, and more recently Optus, also have great equity in the game." I hate the way he throws in Optus at the end there. It's like the New South Wales Rugby League going back 90 years and more recently Optus.
It's disgusting.
So that was the other sticking point, the pay TV issue. So the ARL was working with Optus, but any peace deal that they came to had to be agreed upon by Optus and Foxtel. So we'll get into how that played out a bit later, but that was another big sticking point. It's all well and good for the ARL to, even if they wanted to cede control, you know, they could make that agreement. But unless Optus was happy with that arrangement, then there was going to be problems. But there were some breakthroughs this month, and one of those was Neil Whittaker, for the first time, using his big league pulpit to mention compromise talks. So in his column, Whitaker wrote, "Without wishing to panic people into a new wave of speculation, we are, however, fast reaching a point where we need to come up with some real answers for our game. While the problems are complex, it's been proven before that they must be sorted out by people within the game, not dictated by those outside it." So that's significant that at this point in time, Whitaker is willing to go public in Big League and actually make a formal address that things were happening and they were looking at getting the competitions together.
The public disgust by this point was palpable, evidenced by the viewership and attendance rates. I just wonder how long, if they thought in their heads, could they even go like one more year like this?
Yeah, I don't think so. Yeah. I really don't. As close as we came to getting to that point at a couple of times in this story, it just would have been the ruin of the game, you know? As rugby league, it's always going to survive and maybe we do get together, but it just would have been a disaster. So I think a day after, or, you know, a couple of days after that big league column, Neil Whitaker then poured water on his statement saying, "I think you're reading that things have gone a lot further than they actually have. Talks are only in the preliminary stage and there's a long way to go." And I think this is something that you see all year, just the public being given this sense that it's all happening and then having that taken away from them. And then the story repeating itself every 2 or 3 weeks until it finally got together. So at this point, Neil Whitaker set a deadline at the end of July for significant progress to have been made. This was the first deadline on peace talks that was issued publicly that would then have to be walked back a few times. Or maybe it's just your definition of significant progress. It can be rubbery enough to say that that has happened. Then we get to July, and in planning for peace, Super League put forward a moratorium on player signing so that clubs could re-sign their own players but couldn't approach players from other clubs.
You want to talk about torturing club administrators?
Yeah.
To hamstring them like that with one hand behind their back. Mate, I need to sign this guy. We're getting him. We're going to win the comp.
Yeah. And the thing about the moratorium was that it was designed to be bipartisan. So it was only going to work if both competitions agreed to it. And I don't know if this was a game by Frickberg to say it publicly to make sure the ARL had no choice but to do it. But in his comment, Frickberg said, "I'm fully expecting the ARL to follow suit tomorrow as this was a joint initiative." Neil Whitaker was blindsided by this and said, "I think the media release is a little premature and it's also one I didn't see before its release. So I guess I'm disappointed by that. We discussed in broad terms what we needed to do to take away as much of the petty confrontation that exists between the two parties as we can. And I said that before I could make any comment on this issue, I would take it to my clubs." So Frickberg's got out before he could do that and said that the ARL would join. Whitaker did take it to the clubs who, you know, as you mentioned, wouldn't be happy. They weren't. Souths in particular were really angered by it because they, for the first time in a while, had money in the bank to spend on players and were left with no one to spend it on. But they were eventually able to get it over the line and happen. So that was announced on the 3rd of July. By the 9th of July, that moratorium had already been breached, with reports later proved accurate of Richie Barnett switching from the Sharks to the Roosters. By mid-August, it had become a complete joke. So Rod Reddy was talking about getting players for 1998. And then was said, "What about the moratorium?" And he replied, "Ah, yes, but obviously other clubs don't seem to worry about it, so we're not too worried about it either."
The rules are just a suggestion, I believe.
Yeah. I like this from Jeff Carr. He was asked, about what would happen if a team did decide to break the moratorium. "There's no monetary fine. My understanding that it's a gentleman's agreement."
We're in trouble then.
How many gentlemen's agreements need to be broken in rugby league before anyone learns that there aren't any gentlemen here?
But the funny thing is they all consider themselves gentlemen.
Yeah.
And there was an excuse why they had to break the gentleman's agreement. He did this, so I did this. I'm still a gentleman.
And I like when they say, "In my day, all we needed was a handshake." And it's like, yeah. And then you went about ignoring any terms that you'd broken. So August saw some progress and some setbacks. One that could be viewed in either sense is Optus committing to its previously agreed funding of ARL clubs, which put the ARL on a surer footing for compromise talks, but at the same time made clubs less willing to merge because now they knew they had the money coming in. And so that was an obstacle to clubs agreeing to merge. So maybe it's no coincidence then that August was a time where you saw ARL administrators and figures on that side of the game coming out publicly with bold statements cursing Super League. So George Piggins, they raped us, not the other way around. The ARL should now hold the upper hand in negotiations. Rex Mossett, Murdoch, Rebo and all their crew should be tarred and feathered for what they've done to a once proud sport. I'm for the ARL and no compromise. Phil Gould, a bit more equivocal. Personally, I'd like to see the ARL go it alone, and I'd tell Super League to go to hell. Clearly, that's not the right thing for the game.
Now, you want to talk about a triple crown of all-time backwards belligerent assholes? That's, I mean, you got Ricky Stewart knocking on the door, but I mean, yeah. That's pretty solid.
They're up there. So at this point, it actually came from Michael Hill at Newcastle making a comment that they would absorb the Hunter Mariners at best in any reunified competition. Neil Whittaker came out and told club bosses to just keep your mouth shut. You know, talks are going on, but the public sniping is not in anyone's interests. On top of that, he also came out with another deadline saying that a finalized competition structure needed to get done by the end of September if there could be one competition in 1998. He said, "The worst thing we could do is hang up our boots in September and the public not know what's happening next year." So that was the worst thing they could do, and they duly did it. So the issue of control was a persistent point. So Super League was still unwilling to give any ground, and they weren't willing to give it without a firm commitment from Optus. So the money that Optus had agreed to only went through 1999, and I think it's a reasonable point from Super League to say, well, that's great, but we're committed to funding the game for 15 years. If Optus aren't delivering the same, why are we giving ground on control of the game? And so with all this, the ARL clubs were advised to prepare for two competitions. Peace looked far off and it didn't look like it was going to happen at this point. But shortly after this, we actually got an agreement. So a proposal was put forward from Super League to the ARL. So, you know, there were various options that could be, you know, rejected or approved, coming down to the number of teams and those issues about financial control. So one idea was that the ARL would get veto rights on a unified board. So there were concessions being made and the proposal was accepted with the idea that now it had to be put to the clubs and get their viewpoint. One of the sticking points was the name. And at this stage, so this is August 1997, Super League were demanding that the competition in 1998, the unified competition, be called Super League.
Why?
As we said before, I can kind of understand it in February and March. Super League are bullish. They think they've got the products. They think by August, the public are going to be in love with the Super League brand. You get to August and it couldn't be further from the truth. I don't understand why you'd be so intransigent about this issue.
No one loves the logo more than me, still to this day. As far as beautiful aesthetics, I love the brand, but I mean, it was absolutely poisonous by that point.
Yeah. And I wonder how much of wanting to retain the name comes down to just looking like you've won. So at the expense of good business sense, they just want to look like they won.
It was such a great effort to come up with the NRL brand as well. I'm so surprised, actually, to this day, how well that worked.
Yeah.
It's absolute perfection. But even when I hear about the English Super League now, all I think about is Super League.
Mm-hmm.
Still toxic brand in my mind.
Yeah. So at this point in time, the agreement was put to the clubs to vote on. Some within the ARL were urging resistance. So John Reardon, one of the vice presidents of the New South Wales Rugby League, said that they need to vote this down and go it alone. Publish a draw now for a 12-team competition in 1998. But it was up to the leagues to convince their clubs. So for Super League, that was no problem because they essentially own their clubs. The ARL, it was going to be more problematic. So Super League could technically order amalgamations. The ARL didn't have that same power with its clubs. So it was going to take a lot of work to get this over the line to the clubs. So Neil Whittaker met with club bosses to try to sell them on the idea. Expecting resistance and getting it from figures at South, one South insider said, why should the ARL even talk to them after what's happened? Super League wouldn't be able to sell a postage stamp. All they've managed to do is lose money. Not really helpful in terms of getting this thing done. But it's like, yeah, you know, these business geniuses, what have they actually achieved?
It was like a normal rugby league incineration on steroids, wasn't it, really?
Yeah.
Just your average waste, but turned up to 11.
Turning it up to 11 sums up 2GB listeners who were polled on whether the ARL should pursue compromise talks and got a 96.9% no vote.
You rile up morons with talkback. What do you expect?
But I think all this belligerence is undermined by the big issues, and I think Norm Tasker does a really good job of summing that up. The general feeling among clubs is that Super League started all the trouble, they've failed to grab the high ground, and no concessions should be made to them now that they're in trouble. That scenario fails to take into account, of course, the small matter of News's financial contribution, and the fact that the game is so broken by events of the past 3 years that News Limited money remains vital to its resuscitation. So, with all this happening and the proposal put to the clubs, News Limited ends up pulling out of the proposal on the 18th of August because of some changes that the ARL wanted to make. So there were various stumbling blocks. One of them was that $300 million that the ARL wasn't budging on and News weren't either. The other was the Optus issue. So Colin Sanders at Super League made the insinuation that Optus were the ones pulling the strings and that they were the ones that forced the ARL to insert these changes. He said, can we really sit down and talk to the people who are going to make the decision? And if it is Optus, and we don't have any problem with that, well, let's sit down at the table and talk to them. Whittaker denied being Optus's puppet and said that they weren't Optus's requirements. They were the Australian Rugby League's. But it was clear that this was going to be solved at a level above Neil Whittaker and the ARL. So the pay TV situation had to be sorted out. I'm not going to spend any detailed time talking about the state of the game. I don't want to bore everyone with cable rollout projects, etc. But I think it is worth putting into perspective where pay TV was in 1997. And where it was, you know, circling down the drain with the rest of News Limited's $300 million. So there are reports that pay TV had already lost over $1 billion, plenty more to come. And there was basically no way out. I can't remember if we brought it up in our pay TV chapter, but one of the issues was that they had to do all these deals and to get the content they needed to get their networks up and running. Both Foxtel and Optus had wildly overpaid for rights from US TV companies and film studios.
Come in, spinner.
Yeah. So they made these deals where they said, you know, we're going to have 300,000 subscribers the first year, then 500 the second year, and then we'll have 1 million in three, where, you know, they couldn't even hit that first target.
This is what makes me proud, going through these stats and the prep, a bit proud for the game, in that real people in New South Wales and Queensland love rugby league, and they needed real people to watch pay TV, and they only had bullshit to offer, yeah. So they needed rugby league, and it made me feel real proud that we had that sort of power over them.
Yeah, and it wasn't just our power, it was probably even more significant than that were the anti-siphoning laws, which meant that for the average viewer, there was already enough sport that you could watch on free-to-air TV. So, you know, there'd always be cricket, there'd always be rugby league, there'd always be Aussie rules, or whatever else the public wanted to watch in large numbers were protected by the anti-siphoning laws. So that was always going to limit the market. And then the market itself was just not big enough to sustain two pay TV networks.
Well, did they not consider the fact that it's a pretty big country and you've got to roll out actual cable?
Like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Satellite dishes and physically take them out there?
Exactly. And this is where I didn't want to bore the listeners with cable rollout details, but that was actually a big part of it. And there are all these negotiations going on between Foxtel and Optus about sharing the rollout. And then at various points, that was deemed to be anti-competitive, they did that, and it's beyond the scope of our story, but just suffice to say that there was a lot going on with pay TV, and you know, rugby league was only one part of that, but it was a big part of it. So Optus and Foxtel were coming together for a range of different issues that they were both having and ways of trying to rationalize the industry by working together. So even though that was more than rugby league was a big one. And working together on rugby league was a way that the industry as a whole could start to be rationalized. So it was an important step in the process. So Optus joined the compromise talks in August, which it's surprising they weren't part of it earlier, given all this, given the money they were investing and given the fact that they ultimately had to have a seat at the table for any compromise to be reached. And so I went back and listened to the pay TV episode a while ago in preparation, and I made a statement that the league couldn't be settled until pay TV was settled, when in effect, the opposite is kind of true. Because there were so many things going on, Optus and Foxtel needed to come together on a range of issues. But this was one of the big ones that they did get done. So sorting out rugby league was a way in to sorting out the pay TV industry, which thinking about the pay TV industry then, ever since, and especially now, you wonder if they were better off just cutting their losses in 1997.
Well, you know what really makes me sick about this whole war is the fact that it ended up with them just sharing it.
Yeah.
And it could have been just done beforehand.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, just the sickening nature of it.
Yeah. That's the eternal regret. I think it's a key theme in Arco's book. You know, why couldn't they just get it all sorted in 1995, you know? But so September comes, the moratorium was set to end. Talk of extending it was a sign that peace was still some way off. This was going to be resisted by clubs and especially the players' union. And I really feel for the players here. Think of a guy like Chris Lawler at Parramatta. He was unwanted by Parramatta. They'd made that clear. But it's September and he knows he can't stay at his current club. But he can't find a club for 1998 because he can't talk to anyone. So it was just unworkable to keep this moratorium going. So the moratorium ended. Matthew Rodwell made history as the first Super League player. I guess Julian O'Neill, but different circumstances. But the first Super League player to sign back to the ARL, signing a deal with St. George for 1998. And then Richie Barnett, Julie did sign with the Roosters from Cronulla shortly after. So as September drew on and there was still no plan in place for peace for 1998, we saw a revival of the idea of conferences and the Singleton plan, which was brought up again in 1997, the idea that you'd have two separate conferences, one Super League, one ARL, that would then meet in a Super Bowl. Singleton suggested that the Super Conference and the Giltinan Conference as the names.
Looking back at it again at the end of this series, we dodged another bullet. Simplicity is the key for rugby league formatting.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't think it was viewed at this point as a long-term solution. Like Singleton himself said, it would be a bridge. So it was just like, we're getting on here. We're coming into October and we still don't have anything sorted for next year. So it was, are we too late for true compromise in 1998, we have our separate conferences, but then come together. So the whole time, Super League had been saying, we want 12 teams. The ARL had been saying, we want 16 teams. So as sources said, that means we'll get 14, which is ultimately what they voted on. But by October, it was clear that it was too late for that. So Super League accepted that for 1998, it was going to be too late for anything less than a 20-team competition.
Well, it's amazing they got any comp up and running that late in the game, so I'll give them kudos for that. But the fact that at the end of this destruction, they're sharing the pay TV and we've got 20 teams.
To be fair, the 20 teams was a one-year proposition. It was we start with 20 and we whittle it down over the next couple of years. But compromise at this stage was being hampered by the ARL clubs who, you know, it was in their hands ultimately. And for clubs like Balmain and Souths, you're essentially voting for the end of your existence. So I can understand clubs being unwilling to really be pro-compromise. And at the same time, you had Newcastle winning the comp and suddenly there's this little bit of momentum for rugby league. I really like this from Steve Crawley in The Telegraph. Several weeks ago, before peace talks broke down, it was a different story, with some ARL clubs considering mergers. Now, though, with the sniff of survival and a stirring end to the season, courtesy of the Newcastle Knights fairy tale, being cavalier is much more invigorating than boring good business. I just like that. Being cavalier is more invigorating than boring good business. I think so much of the war comes down to that. So with all this going on, you know, talks breaking down, talks happening again, Neil Whittaker thought that something needed to be done to solve this issue once and for all. So with the ARL competition finishing with that grand final, he jumped on the plane on a fact-finding mission to the US.
One more junket.
I love
this. How important could these facts be at this point?
So he said he wanted to learn from the NFL and the experiences they had with their, you know, merger in the late 60s. And Whittaker's comment was, "It was very interesting. I hadn't realized before, but all major sports in America have been through what's happened to us and all resulted in some sort of merger out of it. The people I spoke to weren't around in the 60s, but we talked about how they operate now."
So there's 3 months till the new season. We've got no competition. He's heading over there for a junket. I mean...
and like, jokes aside, I think there are clear learnings to be taken from the US and the experience with the NFL and, you know, basketball had the ABA and, you know, the two baseball conferences, you know, absolutely, there's clear learnings to be taken, but they could probably be just as easily taken by reading a couple of books.
Or a conference call, maybe, yeah. Given that there's a few pressing issues at home. Yeah. But also, what are they going to learn? It's like, well, over here, man, we just have like one team or two per major city. And, you know, lots of people like to watch them and there's lots of money. So you guys have 11 in the one? Okay, well, that's probably wouldn't work.
So there are a lot of things to come together. One is that the issue of the salary cap. It was clear that the clubs couldn't keep spending at the rate they had been. That was going to be one of the things they were voting on. There was a lot of talk about what that salary cap would be and, you know, how players would be affected. Even talk of pay cuts. One mystery Rugby League Week columnist said, "Many of us would not be opposing the decision in court if we were forced to take a pay cut, but there are plenty of players who would. The club surely can't expect players to accept contracts being broken." Which I think that's fair enough. You've signed a contract. As a player, that's for the league to sort out. I've signed this contract. I'm getting my money. You can't then impose a salary cap that takes some of that money out of my hands.
Absolutely.
What I don't expect, the players were polled in the Rugby League Week. So that's fine for the contract you've signed. But in terms of the next contract you sign, do you expect to take a pay cut when you next re-sign? 65% of players said no.
I mean, the ultimate gravy train those 2 years for them, and they still weren't satisfied.
Yeah. So both competitions agreed to go down from $5 to $4 million. I think in the end we got 3.25, so it came down even more. Many players and clubs were unhappy about that. But the player I want to talk about is Aaron Raper. So he was also caught in the crossfire of a system that the ARL had implemented, which would make the salary cap a points-based system. So, you know, we've talked about the unworkability of these points-based systems before. But so before the two competitions came together, but as they were talking about compromise and working on a salary cap, the ARL had announced this point system where each club had 75 points to spend, with more points if you're an Origin player or a Test player, discounts for how much service you'd given, etc. So they announced this point system. Aaron Raper was told that he wasn't wanted for 1998 because they needed to get their points down. So they had to trim 25 points off. Raper, along with a few other players, were shown the door. Replacements brought in from the Crushers, Clinton Shafkowski, Troy Pezzett, and Mark Tukey. All of those players were worth just 1 point, which pretty astute buying from Parramatta.
I just feel sorry for Aaron Raper. I mean, the guy just gets
the
short end of the stick every single time he turns up.
This is what I want to talk about. So he was cut by Parramatta because he was worth too many points. Other clubs couldn't take him on because he was worth too many points, and they'd prefer to, you know, use some of their juniors or development players because they cost less. Raper, understandably disillusioned with the ARL, he said that he would think about signing with a Super League club. "The ARL certainly hasn't done me any favours, and for that reason, I wouldn't think twice about joining a Super League team." Then the NRL's formed. The point system goes out the window. He does go back and plays with Parramatta for 1998, but that was it for his Australian career. And I think there's a fair argument that more than any other player, Aaron Raper's career is defined by Super League. Like every single storyline of his career, he's the son of a staunch ARL legend.
Yeah.
He's the Cronulla refugee to Parramatta. He has the origin incident, you know, making the World Cup squad. And now this, like every single storyline of his career is dominated by the Super League war. I don't know if there's a player who is as affected.
Give him props for showing composure and dignity in all those slights as well, because if that was someone else, myself included, they'd be whining the whole time.
Yeah, so I was just reading that. I just felt so bad for Aaron Raper.
Yeah.
So we go into November and then December. So it's going to be 20 teams, but working towards less. So
can we just stop there and say we're in December 1997 and we haven't got a comp for March 1998?
So we did make some progress with Super League in what was described by Roy Masters as a neat accounting device. They were able to quarantine the $300 million. So I don't know how that works in business terms, but we got past that bridge and we got an agreement. And the clubs were given time to look at this and then it was going to be put to a vote. And that vote wasn't going to be a done deal. So Warren Lockwood at St. George was tipping that it would be rejected, that the ARL clubs wouldn't accept the offer. Ian Frickberg was frantically working the phones the night before the meeting, trying to convince all the clubs to vote for it. And I think that comes down to the fact that clubs were signing their own death warrants if they voted for this proposition. But looking at the big picture, I think clubs realized that they didn't really have much of a choice. It was a gun to the head kind of thing where...
Shocking, yeah.
If they said no, well, who's paying for the game? How do we survive? So the existence of the game wasn't a sure thing if they voted no. So we get to the vote, and this was a vote on 19 points. I'm going to read out these 19 points so you know what was at stake here. So, one, Super League and ARL form a single competition through partnership owned 50% by Super League and 50% the ARL. Two, Super League and the ARL are responsible separately for negotiating with their respective clubs to, if appropriate, arrive at compensation for entering into new arrangements and cancelling existing contracts. Three, new competition grants free-to-air rights to PBL, pay TV rights to Foxtel and Optus, for 3 years, with Foxtel and Optus paying the same amount. Four, 20 teams for 1998, 16 teams for 1999, and 14 for the year 2000. And before the 28th of February 1998, there would be criteria released for survival into 1999 and beyond. Five, in 1998, the 20 teams will be issued with a one-year license. Six, when that license criteria is determined, Brisbane, Newcastle and Auckland will be measured against the criteria with a view to being issued automatic five-year licences. Seven, the 16 teams for 1999 will be determined by the 31st of July 1998. Eight, the licence entitles each club to an annual grant of $2 million and all travel costs for 1998 and 1999. Nine, clubs entering into approved mergers or joint ventures by the 31st of May 1998 will receive a $4 million grant for 1999 and 2000 and a five-year license. 10. Clubs entering into approved mergers or joint ventures by November 30, 1998 will receive $4 million for 99, $3 million for 2000 and a five-year license. 11. The 14 licenses for 2000 will be determined by the 31st of July 1999. 12. In the year 2000, there will be no less than six and no more than eight teams from Sydney, which includes Illawarra. 13. Until 2001, the regions outside Sydney are Adelaide, Melbourne, Auckland, Canberra, Brisbane, North Queensland, Newcastle, Gold Coast, and the Central Coast. 14. The grant of licences for 2000 and beyond will be determined in the following order of priority. A. Merged clubs. B. Regional clubs. C. Standalone Sydney clubs. 15. The ARL will be responsible for managing representative and international fixtures, junior development, the state leagues, international rules, and any other matters agreed by the NRL Corporation. 16. The ARL and Super League will be entitled to a minimum revenue share of $8 million in each year. 17, the board of the NRL Corporation will comprise 6 directors, 3 appointed by Super League and 3 by the ARL. 18, News has first and last right of refusal over broadcast rights for 25 years, but News/Foxtel rights always subject to offer of non-exclusive pay TV rights to Optus. And 19, the NRLC and the partnership will not have deadlock provisions. So those were the 19 points. As you can see, there's a lot still to be sorted out. There's no real competition structure and, you know, all those details were still to be solved. If you were listening closely, you might notice that not all of those came to pass. So for a start, we ended up with 17 teams in 1999. So along the way, various aspects of that proposal was changed as required or, you know, as the game was shaping up. So that was what the clubs and the game were voting on. So Neil Whittaker gets to Moore Park at 6:30. There were going to be a series of meetings at the SFS all day. I love this in that report of Neil Whittaker arriving early. With Christmas only a week away, yesterday was the last possible day for a deal that would salvage a unified competition. I think it goes back to your point of like these arbitrary endpoints. Like, we got to get it done before Christmas.
Probably just getting back from LAX, but on that day anyway.
So the first meeting was the meeting of the New South Wales Rugby League Board. Then at 9, there would be an ARL board meeting. At 10 o'clock, there was to be a meeting with the Country Rugby League, along with the referees and league vice presidents, where Whittaker would basically make the same presentation he'd already made to the New South Wales Rugby League and ARL.
I put it to you that the Country Rugby League meeting would have been the funniest one.
And
then, the game's dying in the bush.
And it's just so funny to me also that they just shove the Country Rugby League and the referees and league vice presidents in together. It's like, you know, oh, where are you going to fit all these? Oh, let's just combine them, okay? So these, you know, CRL and referees, they're, you know, in many ways like the also-rans, but they were an important lobby target because if any clubs were split, their votes were going to be vital to making sure it got over the line. One group that wasn't there was the Players Association. So they presumably would have been shoved into this meeting as well, but they'd been disenfranchised at the previous New South Wales Rugby League General Committee meeting, so they didn't have a voice at all. So following that, there was a clubs meeting. So all of them met together, and then they were all put into, you know, different private boxes to have their own meetings and decide on how they were going to vote. So for Sydney clubs, they had the option of gambling on their own futures by voting no and going standalone, or accepting that the game needed peace and they may be forced into a merger to see that happen.
But mate, if those points were actually accurate in the future, 14 teams by a couple of years later, they're actually knowingly signing their death warrant, like not potentially, guaranteed.
And this is why, like, when I was doing the research for this, I actually did get a bit emotional at this, thinking about these clubs who had resisted, you know, every step of the way and, you know, all this intransigence and just this deep-seated rugby league culture, you know, the Jack Gibson, you can't get the Blazers off these dudes.
Yeah.
These old school guys coming together and ultimately, whether gun to the head or not, you know, they voted for it.
Yeah, incredible.
So finally, there'd be the general committee meeting and then it would be put to the vote. So something touching to me was that Ken Arthurson turned up for the general committee meeting and he was asked about it and, you know, asked about whether he was voting. And he said, "No, I'm not here to vote, but I'd like to ask a few questions. I've been involved since day one. No one wants to see peace more than me."
Real man's man to do that.
Yeah. And I think it's a deserved mark of respect from the ARL that, you know, he wasn't just pushed out the door and, you know, enjoy your life on the Gold Coast. It's like, you're still a part of this. And yes, you have a right to ask questions and see how it all unfolds.
Absolutely.
So they went to the vote and it was done. So in the end, the Tigers and Souths both voted against it, but they were the only dissenters and the deal went through.
Well, could you blame them? They're first on the chopping block.
Yeah, and prescient from George Piggins afterwards, who said, "I'm not a bloke you want to take on because I'm going to give you a hell of a fight. My attitude is stuff 'em.
100% factual.
And just as a counterpoint, you know, going back to Mal really sending the facts to Wally Lewis and making it clear that when I said get stuffed, it wasn't a general get stuffed. It was just a get stuffed on this specific issue. George Piggins, it's very much a general stuffing.
I picture him getting those 19 points and going, I'm not reading that.
Yeah.
The bloody War and Peace.
I'm just going to read this. This was written in the Telegraph by Andrew Stevenson, Kim Sweetman, and John Geddes. I just really like the way this came together. After three bitter years of war and a final full day of meetings, it took only 23 minutes for New South Wales Rugby League delegates to agree to peace with honour. The final vote came down to the 40 wise and gnarled men who run the game when they held session in the cricket auditorium of the Sydney Football Stadium. They entered at 2:50 under a threatening sky, and their decision to call off hostilities was marked not by a puff of white smoke, but a bolt of lightning as a summer storm swept across the SFS.
That's beautiful writing.
Yeah, I really liked that. And that gets us to the end of the chapter and the end of the research journey. As I said, we've got a little epilogue that I'll tell you about, but I don't know, it was quite daunting to me trying to wrap up this chapter, like, you know, looking at all my research notes, deciding who gets the last word in a story we've told for 40 chapters, quotes spanning the early 70s through to the late 90s. So I was looking at all of these notes and thinking about it, and I thought, do we give it to Arco, you know, a nod to the man who probably more than any other individual defined and shaped rugby league at this time, and with his statements, despite having his heart broken by the war, able to bow out on a note of cautious optimism and, albeit grudgingly, a spirit of compromise. Arco said, "If the game is to go ahead, we ultimately had to get together. I really think the game will explode now. The deal is not what I would have liked, but in a compromise, you can't get everything you want." But I thought leaving it with Arco was only telling half the story. So what about John Rebo, you know, the pantomime villain who was, you know, misunderstood and unfairly castigated, and whose parting words stand in for one of our running themes of rugby league men? Rebo said, "The battle got bitter at times, but I hold no grudges against the men from the other side. There was a lot of passion involved, but I always tried not to make it personal. To me, it was business and there are no hard feelings. I've always found Ken Arthurson a man of integrity, and I certainly don't have a problem with him. He had his point of view and I had mine."
Good comment. That's a man's man comment too. It's just, it's easy to make that comment from the attacker side though.
Yeah, totally. So that felt kind of not quite right. So do we leave the past behind and give it to Neil Whittaker, you know, the man who would lead the NRL into this bold new era? "I'm amazed at the resilience of the game of rugby league. Everyone's looking forward to what we do best, and that is fighting on the field." And I think that resilience of rugby league speaks for itself. But I decided ultimately it needed to be a player. So I was trying to find a good statement, and I thought this from Paul Harrigan I really liked. "It's the best Christmas present I could have wished for." So it was a good thing they did get it done before Christmas. Otherwise, the chief...
They had to have it done by Christmas.
Yeah. "Rugby league is better than any other game. And support for rugby league is like a rubber band that you could stretch forever and it will snap back next year."
Well, I'll tell you what, that's probably the best way to leave it, because it is about rugby league men, and there is no bigger rugby league man in heart and soul than the chief. So I like that one.
I like it too, but then I thought, well, we need to hear from a Super League player, Alan Langer. "It's just great we're back together for rugby league's sake. Some of the games will be that much tougher and get the home crowds firing." But ultimately, all of these just seemed a bit too celebratory or a bit too much of an ending for like what was on the field a very underwhelming year of football. And I feel like the saga and how it played out, it doesn't really deserve this, you know, neat, definitive kind of like wrap up.
Absolutely.
So I found something, and I think this quote probably says more about the character of the individual who said it than any sweeping generalization about rugby league players. But there was just something really fitting about it. So I'm just going to read this. This was Michael Kozlowski in the Herald. "The Herald contacted Brad Freddie Fittler at his Sydney home. 'He's asleep,' said a friend of Fittler's. 'Is it important?' Told it was only in reference to World League peace. The reply came, 'I don't think I should wake him. Can you call him back after 5 p.m? At 5:15, we tried again, just ringing for a comment on the peace resolution we offered. I didn't hear about it, Fittler replied. What happened? I just love that for the naivety of Freddy and the nonchalance that, like, this thing that has been raging for...
That absolutely sums it up for rugby players. Yeah.
And I think it's a fitting question to leave the chapter on. What did happen? What did we achieve here? And that is basically what we're going to spend our next episode looking at. So it's not going to be as research intensive as the 40 chapters you've just heard have been. It's going to be very much our personal thoughts, looking ahead at the mergers, the collapse mergers at Souths, at how the NRL has got from where it started to where it is now, and ultimately whether the war was worth it. So that is what we're going to be looking at in our last episode. I will say in the interim before that, I'm going to finally speak to our, you know, someone who has been on a parallel journey with us for some time, Steve Mascord. So I've finally allowed myself to read Two Tribes, and I'm really keen to have a chat to Steve about, you know, his version of the war and compare notes with our version. So that is what you have coming up from us. So there'll be two more episodes and then we've reached the end of the road.
Mate, 40 chapters, what you've done is absolutely bloody incredible. I feel honoured to be part of it.
Well, I'm honoured to have you with me on this journey, mate. But yeah, we'll save the flowers for our last episode. But I won't save the thanks to the listeners who have been incredible for us for 40 chapters. And I hope you'll stick with us for a couple more episodes as we wrap this thing up. But thank you so much for listening and we will be back soon.
Toodaloo.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.